So now, why this title, Art is Thinking, Thinking as Art, and what does it mean? How I came to this title is one of the mysteries of the so-called creative process, which is not exactly what I intend to be talking about this morning. I intend to be talking about a somewhat lower level of mental activity, that is thinking, which I believe is different from creating, but equally mysterious also. I should also indicate that what you have seen here in this video, after a long roundabout way, I shall be trying to explain to you how we came to be doing such things and thinking such things at that time in 1962 or earlier. So that does have relevance to what we'll be talking about. This title, Art is Thinking, Thinking of Art, as often happens when I begin a new work, just popped into my head, my thinking that is, and doggedly lodged there. Where it came from exactly, I don't know, but obviously somewhere from my background of experience, reading, and thinking. The doggedness with which this unelaborated idea or germ of an idea fixed itself in my conscious bemused me, and eventually I was convinced that this idea might be something interesting to work with or play with for at least a while. But would it be an important idea, important work, or important play? That would be determined only if and when, if I ever discovered the meaning of this idea. In this case, I am defining meaning in a rather simplistic way as the effect that an idea has on behavior, my behavior, or the behavior of others with whom I share this idea, or an artwork presumably based on this idea. And now that we have opened that can of worms called definition, let's see what is available to define the two principal concepts in this title, art and thinking. As you might expect, in both cases, there's tons of written material dating back at least to the ancient Greeks about these two concepts. However, I find little or none conclusive and rigorous enough to meet today's definitional standards. We think constantly, and not only when we are awake. I know intuitively when we are thinking, and we think we know when, even sometimes, what other people are thinking. We believe the reason we think is to understand past and present events or situations, to solve problems, to anticipate and plan future events, and project and perhaps even track and identify ourselves as living individuals, as per Descartes' famous proposition, I think, therefore I am. We'll return to this proposition a little later, but for now we continue. At best, I find thinking a fuzzy terminology to cover a wide array of active mental activity, such as knowing or believing, projecting, translating, imagining, judging, reasoning, etc. We can all do it, and survival in the modern world depends upon us doing it, but we really don't know how we do it. Neuroscience has identified numerous areas of the brain where, at least at the time of examination, various mental activities seem to be located. In other words, the activity of seeing, the perception, seems to be in this area, hearing perhaps here, speaking language someplace else. They have also discovered that some activities move their position in the brain if a part of the brain becomes damaged, or if that activity becomes less important or obsolescent, then that activity might move to another place of the brain where there's less demand on it. We've also discovered that higher levels of mental activity, such as perceiving, hearing a musical composition, engages several areas of the brain simultaneously, which exchange and engage and integrate information between each other, somehow or other, about the perceived stimulus to give it meaning. But what are the rules and the guidelines which organize this exchange and integration of information? For a while, spurred by the development of computer science and the search for artificial intelligence, great efforts were made to develop information processing and decision-making models describing the routing and the integration of information between various systems, meaning areas in the brain. However, quantum theorists have thrown some sand into these gears recently, suggesting that indeterminacy cannot be ignored when constructing such models. In other words, things do not progress quite as linearly and as rigidly as originally hoped. Thus, it seems we can never be quite certain or predict how something, thinking in this case, is happening if we don't know exactly when and where it will happen. We are only certain after the fact of the happening that it did happen. That is what we did when we thought. In the end, how important is it to closely define thinking? We do it every day without thinking about it. Is it not enough to say that we know what thinking is when we see it or hear it or think of it? Or, as Louis Armstrong famously said when asked to define jazz, "Man, if you gotta ask, you're never gonna know." I'm going to skip over the problem of defining art, because as students in the School of Art here and across Community College, one of your major and enduring tasks in these years is to wade through the many theories and definitions, to assimilate, to deconstruct, to revive, to revise, or even invent a definition which you feel comfortable with when asked to talk about your work as an artist. If your work has integrity, its realization will not depend upon current theory or popular definitions. Theory follows practice. Thus, I don't wish to preempt your pleasures and miseries in your attempts to define what it is you are doing as an artist. That should be your pleasure in your business alone. Now, to get back to the meat of this talk, art is thinking, thinking is art. You will remember when I quoted Descartes' earlier proposition, "I think, therefore I am." I promised to return to this idea, and so I'll do so now. I'm not going to engage in a discourse with this proposition, perhaps the most widely quoted and argued proposition in Western philosophy, but rather I will try to shed light on what I'm talking about by inverting the sentence and adding one small word to create a different proposition to help focus on our thoughts of art as thinking, thinking as art. The proposition would now simply read, "Therefore, I am what I think. I am what I think." For the purposes of this talk, we're going to temporarily forget about genetics, okay? And I would also argue that this proposition, "I am what I think," is perhaps more accurate than the saying which you all know, "You are what you eat." Thus, we could construct an argument as follows. What I do when I make art is a product of who I am, one. Two, who I am is a product of what and how I think. Three, therefore, what and how I think is defined by what I do when I make art. Once again, what I do when I make art is a product of who I am. Who I am is a product of what and how I think. And three, therefore, what and how I think is defined by what I do when I make art. Considering that thinking includes the integration of culture, history, and other social parameters, I think this line of argument should raise only a few minor objections. Logically, art is a product of thinking. Art is thinking. And thinking is manifested in the product called art. Thinking as art. These are, of course, only a few statements about a theoretical concept. And as I suggested before, theory follows practice. So now we need some concrete examples to give substance to this discussion. First, let me set the historical stage on which these examples first appeared. We're now back in the mid-1950s, early 1960s in Europe, America, and Japan. Europe was rebuilding physically and intellectually after the devastation of the Second World War. In Japan, people were still dying 10 years later as a result of the atomic bombs over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In the United States, the anti-communist witch hunts of Senator Joseph McCarthy were scaring every liberal around into silence. The Korean War was still a hot war, and the social revolution of the civil rights movement was beginning to brew warm. Disappointment and dissatisfaction with all past regimes was rampant, and the times cried for change. I would suggest at least four important intellectual developments which began to influence the search for change and the general development of arts or advanced arts at that time. I would suggest existentialism, essentially a European development, Zen Buddhism, a Japanese import to the west and east coast of the United States, which had considerable influence on many young people. The quantum theory of mechanics and the development and experiments of behavioral psychologists. As young rebel artists, in the broad sense to include both the performing arts and the liberal arts, or the literary arts, as well as the visual arts, in Japan, US, Europe, and elsewhere, this would include Latin America, and even in some cases, behind what was then the Iron Curtain of the Soviet Union, we were determined to change the world through our art. And these intellectual developments were welcome fodder. We feasted on them and tried to extract whatever possible clues as to how to develop a new art from the revelations. And for the most of us, our work was about out with the old and in with the new. One of the primary ambitions of the constellation of artists known under the banner of Fluxus was the liberation of art from its material base. That is to create an ephemeral art immune to the corruption of the art market. In other words, the art we attempted to create would not be something that you could own, you could trade, you could merchandise, buy, and possess. That was counter to our ideal of the ideal art. The second ambition, or a second ambition, was the elimination of a certain kind of elitism, which required highly specialized training, expensive equipment, and means and skills, such as very expensive electronic music studios, or 12 years of 6-hour daily practice at the piano. The whole early Fluxus effort is perhaps best summed up in a statement that George Brecht made during the famous class that John Cage taught at the New School of Social Research in New York in 1958, in which during discussion of these matters, George said, "What we need is not technical or manual virtuosity, but spiritual virtuosity." And so with that statement, in a way, a lot of new ground was broken, and several people arrived independently in Japan, in Germany, and in the States at a form you might call, what you might call a form of art, which was ephemeral, immaterial, and involves the mental processes, which we call thinking. George Brecht named his works in this area events. Sometimes these works were instructions or near instructions that could be carried out and performed, but generally rather ambiguous in their detail as to how they should be performed. I could suggest two. One work consisted simply of a card about this size on which was written the word exit. How do you perform this? Do you perform this? Do you only think about it? Do you consider all the meanings of it, or do you just forget it? These are all thinking activities that you have to undergo when confronting this instruction or the statement exit? Is it an instruction, or is it simply a statement such as their exit? It sticks in your head, and it works somehow or other. Another of his more ambiguous works, which I think fulfills this quality or the qualities of being immaterial and ephemeral in a sense, was another card on which was written at the top, concert for clarinet. And then in the next line followed a large black dot, like a period. And after that, it said nearby. How do you interpret that? What does it mean? Is it something to be interpreted, or only something to be imagined? This, in a way, reminds you in any way of the so-called teachings of the Zen masters when a student answered a question. They would be slapped on the head whether the answer was right or wrong. Or of various Zen koans where there is great ambiguity and apparently nonsense, but not so nonsensical built into the structure. In other words, what was being sought was a kind of thinking, and the word holistic was popular at the time, a kind of thinking that one found in Zen, or let's say experiencing, as opposed to the linear thought or thinking that we presumed had dominated Western philosophy. And because of the failure of this linear thinking, or presumed linear thinking, to prevent such catastrophes as wars, it became, it fell into disrepute. So there was this effort, as I said before, to develop a kind of non-linear thinking, or a process towards non-linear thinking, or at least to develop an art which simply involved thinking. Other examples before I suggest some of my own. Yoko Ono, who you may know, was also originally a important Fluxus artist, had a work which simply said on a card, flying. And how do you do this? Do you take a plane? Probably not. That would be too obvious. Do you fly out of window? Unfortunately, some people tried that and didn't work. And another important Fluxus artist who has argued long with Joseph Kusuth that he was actually the developer of concept art, which this idea of art as an idea, art as thinking, thinking as art, is also closely related to, if not identical. Henry had also a work which was on a larger card and a sentence which read, "This sentence is not in French," which seems to be an obvious statement, but once again it asks questions. Well, why isn't it in French? Why did you say this? And so forth. And requires, once again, a kind of thinking which confronts us. My own, you might say, experiments or explorations in this area began independent of this statement of George Brecht. I did not know him at the time. And in the particular time that this class took place, I was not in the States, I was in Europe. and was not a part of this class. But I had had the experience later of attending a world premiere of a new work by Karlheinz Stockhausen, Kantate for piano and two percussionists, and found the work quite, I must say, and disappointingly so, unconvincing, even though it was nearly an hour long and performed by three of the virtuosos, greatest virtuosos of contemporary music at that time, who had spent, I learned later, more than 220 hours of rehearsal time preparing this work. I think it hasn't been performed many times since then. But in any case, it did anger me considerably, and I spent maybe the next 3 weeks almost in solitary confinement, self-imposed solitary confinement, trying to reason or understand how one could develop an art or a music that didn't require this kind of virtuosity, this kind of extensive preparation, and would be closer to a, shall we say, lay public. Eventually, I came up with a work that became a classic Fluxus performance. It's called Paper Piece, which I think was probably the first work, although there have been many paper pieces by other people since then, to actually use paper in all its various forms as an instrument to produce a coherent artistic work. And the work and a, let's say, concept which allowed amateurs who were spiritually or mentally alert to participate with as much, concentration and contribute equally as a professional musician, perhaps even more so because they had no presupposed ideas of what one should do with this concerning rhythm, harmony, and so forth. That was one aspect of my particular approach to this. And the second aspect came from my realization, having been a professional performing musician and symphony orchestra player, that at least 50% out of my enjoyment in performing a particular work of music came from the sheer physical and mental activity of reading the notes of the music and making and transforming them into a musical sound through certain physical actions, as well as when playing in an orchestra, listening to what others were doing so that I could coordinate my work and gear it into the work that they were playing, in other words, the notes that they were playing, so that there was a blend, a balance, and a continuity. And this type of mental and kinetic activity, I realized, was completely lost on the audience. They were passive listeners. At best, if they were performers of any instrument, they could imagine what they would be doing if they were performing this. But in general, they were only hearing the auditory. And this sincerely limits the appreciation, in my view, of the work. So I attempted then to create, not always but often, works which involved, quote, audience participation, or where the audience was involved in the realization of the work. And Paper Piece, although it wasn't written or intended at that for that in the very beginning, but after about the first five performances, it drifted by itself into the audience, and I realized that it was an audience participation piece as well. And so it has continued that way since then. And then other works that I did later followed through on this involvement of the audience, sometimes in which the whole audience is performer and realizes the work. But there was also a series of short works which were somewhat similar to Zen Koan's, or small performance events which were intended to take place, a set of instructions, but the instructions for the most part could only be realized in your head mentally, or would preferably only take place in your head. Sometimes some people have tried to perform them, but it's not the same as the action that takes place in your head. I will just read a couple of these now, and you'll have a sample of what I'm talking about. Think of number six, bark like dog. Think of number six twice. Stand up. Do not think of number six. Sit down. Think of number six. Bark like dog. Then there's another one. This one could be performed or it could not be performed. It's probably even better not to perform it live. Enter bakery, smell, leave. Enter second bakery, smell, leave. Enter third bakery, smell, leave. Continue until appetite is obtained. This one is, I think, very visual and poetic. Think color of brown, azure. Think smell of roasting coffee beans. Think feel of brown suede leather. Think color of cognac. Think smell of coconut shell crabs. Think feel of coconut brown Indian silk, lavender. Think color of orange. Think smell of apricots. Think feel of gold fish, iris. Think color of nicotine stained fingers. Think smell of sweat stained shirts. Think feel of scaly orange iron rust, scarlet. Think color of blue sulfate. Think smell of blue black figs. Think taste of burning purple smoke, violet or pink. What I think is important to notice here, this could almost be read or might be mistaken as simple poetry, but the instruction to think before each description of a color or a taste or a sound places it, I think, in a different realm. It's an instruction, it's a command in a sense, and my hope, of course, was that it would trigger a specific mental activity and direct that. You might say that's not unlike poetry, but this was more explicit. And then a final one, which once again is something that could be performed, but not really, as you will see. There are instructions which could be realized, and then instructions which you can't realize for an audience, and so you could realize it for yourself, both physically and mentally. Wash hands, put on gloves, and think dietitian, obstetrician, pedicure, etc. Take off gloves and wash hands, put on gloves and think fop, fad, banker, boxer, etc. Take off gloves and wash hands. Put on gloves and think garbage man, boogeyman, Eichmann, etc. Take off gloves and wash hands. So those are three examples of my work in this area of trying to create, as I said, thinking as art. What you saw up here before, you might say, was another form of thinking as art, because it meant breaking certain taboos, which is a mental process in and of itself. The events, as in music, were ephemeral. What you retain from that is the memory of the event, of what you perceived. And because of its, revolutionary, at that time, at least, character, it requires a rethinking in the minds of the audience of what the purpose of art is, was, and did that action of these events meet or fulfill those purposes, and what would come next. Okay. Well. Oh, I should have asked, did anyone understand what I was talking about?